KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
Hello from South Berkeley, below Ashby.
Coming up, we'll travel between California's Central Valley and Punjab, India, to see how the Green Revolution has transformed agriculture and immigration.
Balveed says out of the 50 farming families in this village, 15 have left for other countries. Varinder adds, and everyone would leave if they could.
How a community of Punjabi farmers ended up in California. Then we'll hear from San Francisco muralist and tattoo artist Mel Waters about paying tribute to the city's history through his art.
You know, you are putting on a performance as an artist. You know, you're on a stage. You know, they're watching you create.
Stay with us. Cross Currents is next. Didar Singh Baines is known as the Peach King of California. He's from Punjab, a region in South Asia that was split between India and Pakistan in 1947. Just over a decade later, Didar arrived in the U.S. with $8 in his pocket. He became a farm worker, and today he's one of the largest peach farmers in the world. Didar is part of a sizable community of Punjabi farmers in California's Central Valley, growing fruits, nuts, and other produce. These farmers come from a region that's famous for its fertile land and its farmers. So how and why did they end up in California? KALW's Kaval Roop Kaur Singh covered that in a story that won the Best Investigative Reporting Award from the San Francisco Press Club this year.
To find an almond, you have to crack open the layers that conceal it. You have to get through the green leathery exterior shell to the rough brown interior shell deep in the center. There, you'll discover the small sweet white nut, something to chew on, like a kernel of truth waiting to be found. Sandeep Singh is cracking open almonds on his 70-acre farm in Tracy, California. He picks one off a tree to show me the inside.
Mm-hmm. While the nuts are on the tree, mm-hmm. It's called a shell, the outer shell, the green one.
California produces 4/5 of the world's almonds. Almonds are a $5 billion industry for the state, and Sandeep is now a small part of it.
These are young trees. These are like 4th leaves. They grow really big.
Sandeep marvels at how tall his trees will eventually be. He says they'll grow up to 3 times their current height, and they're already 12 feet tall. Taller trees mean a lot more almonds, which is good for business.
You're looking at, I guess, is the only business in the world. It used to pay itself in 2 years. It was a serious money.
But it isn't easy money. Almond farming is costly, and it's hard work.
I'm looking to buy that all the tools or stuff for harvesting because it costs a lot.
Sandeep immigrated to the U.S. from the state of Punjab in northern India when he was 19 years old. He sought economic opportunities and chose not to go to college, but to work instead.
I really wanted to help out my family back in Punjab, my dad, my grandparents, and my brother, my sister.
He took a job as a construction worker, then as a taxi driver in New York, then as a truck driver in California. But 3 years ago, he decided to return to his agricultural roots. Sandeep may be a young farmer in California, but he comes from a family that's been farming for generations. His father was a farmer, his grandfather was a farmer, his great-grandfather was a farmer, on and on, as far back as he can go. Actually, his family is still farming today, on their ancestral land in the state of Punjab in northern India. So why did Sandeep come to California to farm when he could have just farmed where he grew up? To answer that, we'll go to Punjab, to the small village where Sandeep was born. I'm standing in the village of Pero Munna, near the city of Ludhiana in Punjab, India. Sandeep's ancestors came and settled in this village about 300 years ago. They've been farming ever since. Today, on their 17 acres of land, they grow rice and wheat, like most farmers in Punjab. But Balveer Singh, Sandeep's father, says they've been struggling to make ends meet. He says, we can hardly make enough money to survive by farming. After the harvest is over, when we're balancing our accounts, we find that we barely have enough left to eat. We aren't able to save money for anything else. Balveer says that's partly because of how expensive farming has become in the last half century. It wasn't always that way. Back when we had a well on our farm, he says, I used to operate it myself. It didn't cost much. We had two oxen that pulled water from the well. We would feed them grain, lentils, chickpeas, sugar, whatever we had at home. We never had to buy anything for them. Fifty years ago, that's how irrigation used to happen in Punjab, with water wheels attached to wells, pulled round and round by oxen. Today, most farmers in Punjab use tube wells. Tube wells are long pipes that bore down into aquifers deep underground and pump the water up, supplying it through pipes to the farmland. Sandeep's brother, Virinder Singh, shows me the tube well on their family farm. Virinder opens the door to a dark room filled with switches used to operate the tube well. When his family installed it back in 1965, the water was 15 feet below the ground. Now, Virinder says, they have to drill down 200 feet to get their water. And the water levels continue to recede. Balveer says, in the next 20 years, we may not have any water left. But how can water disappear in Punjab? The soil-rich state is full of rivers. It's actually named for the five rivers that flow through it. It's historically known as one of the most fertile regions on earth. 60% of Punjabis work in agriculture, and their small state provides much of the food for one of the largest nations on earth. Virinder Singh and I take a walk on their family's farmland. All around me, rice plants sit in fields flooded with water for miles and miles. Virinder tells me they will sit like this for almost 5 months, using water 24 hours a day. But Balveer, Virinder's father, remembers a time when they didn't grow rice at all. He says, we used to grow cotton, corn, wheat, and sugarcane. There was no rice back then. Things started to change in 1965. That year, they had their first tube well installed. And it was the year the first high-yielding varieties of rice were introduced to Punjab. The seeds of the Green Revolution were planted.
A helpful way to think of the Green Revolution is as a capitalist marketing campaign that sort of got out of hand. My name is Eric Holt Jimenez. I'm the executive director of Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy in Oakland, California.
To understand the Green Revolution, we must go back to the years immediately after World War II. Fire! The U.S. had stockpiles of chemicals, tanks, and other equipment left over from the war. The chemicals were turned into pesticides and fertilizers. The tanks were turned into tractors. The government and banks gave out loans to farmers to buy this equipment and increase production.
And we did, incredibly. And that was very important because that extra food production not only fed the United States, it fed Europe.
In 1944, the Rockefeller Foundation funded the scientist Norman Borlaug to go to Mexico. He developed high-yielding varieties of wheat called miracle wheat. Around the same time, the corporations that produce agricultural equipment were trying to expand. Eric says this is how the Green Revolution began.
The Green Revolution was a campaign to export not just the products, but the form of agricultural production. to the third world.
Punjab was flooded with high-yielding seeds, chemical fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, advanced farming equipment, and scientists trained by U.S. universities. As food production grew, Norman Borlaug was hailed as the scientist who would end world hunger. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970.
The Green Revolution has not yet been won. It is true that the tide of battle against hunger has changed for the better during these past 3 years. But tides have a way of flowing and ebbing again.
Whole nations bought into Norman Borlaug's ideas. Balveer Singh remembers when India invested in miracle wheat. In 1966, the government bought thousands of tons to increase the nation's wheat production. He says, the first seed we ever got from a foreign country came from Mexico. It was for wheat. I ask him if it actually helped produce more wheat. He says it did for a while, but today it doesn't really make a difference. We have to spend so much money, he says. We get more wheat, but it costs so much to grow. So even if there's more wheat, what's the point? His son Varinder agrees. The cost of production has increased so much, but the price of our crops hasn't, he says. Miracles can have consequences. More food means more dependence on water, chemical fertilizers, and pesticides in order to grow crops. Balveer says most farmers in his village have become indebted, and that debt continues to grow. On average, each farmer in my village is about 2 million rupees in debt, he says. For some, it may be 5 million, for some, 1.5 million, but 2 million is about the average. That's more than $30,000. And this is in a state where the average annual income is about $1,000 per person. Balveer says the land has become dependent on pesticides. The first pesticide stopped working after a while. Then we had to buy more expensive ones, he says. Then those stopped working. Every 5 or 6 years, we have to buy new ones. Eric Holt Jimenez calls this the pesticide treadmill. It's when farmers are taking out credit in order to buy more and more pesticides, more and more fertilizer, and getting diminishing returns.
So there's a cost-price squeeze between more and more costs, higher and higher costs for the factors of production, and then lower and lower price for the goods that the farmers sell. That's a characteristic of people who are swept up in the Green Revolution and the capitalist food system.
That's what happened with Balveer and his potato crop. When we grew potatoes, it cost us 180 rupees per bag, Balveer says. But they were selling at 150. Varinder adds, it costs us more to grow the potatoes than we can sell them for. The Ludhiana district, where Balveer and his family live, received lots of attention during the Green Revolution. 50 years ago, it was thought to be one of the areas with the most potential for success. But now, people want to leave. Balveer says out of the 50 farming families in this village, 15 have left for other countries. Varinder adds, and everyone would leave if they could. I ask Balveer if he wants the rest of his family to leave and join his son, Sandeep, in Modesto. I would want us to, he says. But who would stay and take care of our ancestral land?
All right, dear. I'm going to pull it out because I'm going to load it up and take it to the shop.
Almost 10,000 miles away, Sandeep Singh tends to his farm in California's Central Valley. He sends money home to his family regularly. He even helped them build the house they live in now. He says his peers who left Punjab are doing well.
If you go down south to Fresno, Bakersfield, you see every other farm is owned by Punjabis.
But he says that those left in Punjab aren't doing so well. Farmers like Sandeep have left the country where the Green Revolution was carried out. They've come here instead, to the country that created it. And more are coming. This may be one result of the Green Revolution that its founders never expected. For Cross Currents, I'm Kamalroop Kaur Singh.
That story was made possible in part by the International Center for Journalists. It was part of a series that recently won an award for excellence in investigative reporting by the San Francisco Press Club. And we'll hear part two tomorrow, or check it out right now at KELW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Henat Baba. You might not be familiar with the name Mel Waters, but you may recognize his artwork. He's frequently sponsored by the San Francisco Arts Commission and painted some of the city's most iconic murals, from the Carlos Santana tribute wall in the Mission District to his Jerry Garcia piece in The Hate. Mel recently opened his own tattoo parlor and art gallery, Moonrise Tattoos, in the Sunset District. He stopped by KELW to talk about being a new business owner and leaving his mark on the San Francisco street art scene.
I was a kid that doodled on my classmates' notebooks, my notebook, binder paper, you know. It was popular to draw your friend's name on the back of their, or on the bottom of their JanSport backpack. That was, like, really cool. I think it started with graffiti first. I had to find my way through letters. You know, I had to find an identity as a graffiti artist first. But as that time went on, it became more than letters. It became also characters, you know, and the characters from the B-boy character to more so portraits, faces. And I was really attracted to that and trying to achieve finer art with the spray can. I loved what I was doing. I was making money, working, you know, a young man working. But man, that passion was kicking in. You know, I was still young. I was only 20. So the juices were flowing with art because it was always around. I indulged in, you know, painting a lot at home while I was working my 9-to-5. So it was like my hobby to paint on the weekends and during the week after work. But as the years went by, it just, like, I kept feeding this dream job of being a full-time artist. And it just, 6.5 years later, I put in my 2 weeks notice because I had got this opportunity in Southern California to paint this guy's motorcycle shop on reality television at that time on the Speed Network, which was pretty, like, amazing. So I felt like I can leave it behind and make a living off of art, which was, like, super scary. Some artists might be uncomfortable with crowds, but I think when you're an artist, you're trying to do your best out there and give the people something beautiful. You know, you are putting on a performance as an artist. You know, you're on a stage. You know, they're watching you create. You're putting art in their face. So it's kind of hard to avoid that. But, I feel like I want to pour my heart into it every time I'm out there. So, you know, I'm not just out there putting on a show. I'm out there trying to create this picture that can hopefully positively influence the community in a bright way. I'm all about paying respect to culture and history through my art. especially the local heroes and beyond. I mean, San Francisco's home to Carlos and Jerry and some others, because it's like the soundtrack to the history and the culture. So that, you know, they were my subject matter. I grew up around tattoos. You know, my uncles had them. My grandfather's brothers had them. So it was just more so, you know, it was a culture. So I saw like gang tattoos, house, you know, prison style tattoos, homemade tattoos. I saw pictures of my uncles in the Philippines, in a prison in the Philippines, you know, showing off their tattoos. So it's like, I grew up around it early, and I got my first tattoo when I was 16 years old. My uncle was saying, hey, you know, when you turn 16, you're gonna have to get your first tattoo. But I was scared, but I did it. And, you know, from there on, I was never really worried or scared or shy about tattoos or people with tattoos. It didn't scare me, you know, it wasn't intimidating. It was just more so, okay, yeah, I know what that's about. It definitely was the seed. I mean, it didn't sprout until maybe, wow, like a long time after, but it eventually did grow once it got some sunlight, you know? The first tattoo I put on was on myself. It was shop protocol that an apprentice tattoos themselves. So I think all the friends lined up and they were all circled up around me. You know, at that point I had learned how to set up and, you know, get everything together. But actually tattooing, I had never put ink in nobody. So it was scary and it was terrible. Like, I mean, I actually did all right, but got some help every now and again, but it was just, it's hard. It was hard. It was really, really hard. My tattoo shop, Moonrise Tattoo, is coming up on its 1 year anniversary. I opened in December of 2017. And, you know, we're closing in on December of 2018. So yes, it will be almost 1 year for Moonrise Tattoo. Through my career, I've tried to just now find those people who are like, who have established themselves in music or history and culture, but bring them back and bring them new light.
You can check out Mel Waters' new mural with Presida Eyes at 350 Ellis Street Apartments in San Francisco. Find out more by going to KALW or, better yet, subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Get the latest from Cross Currents right in your inbox. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Lance Gardner, Angela Johnston, Priya Mahadevan, True Quinn, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Gabe Graben, and Tariq Foda. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Tino Drima from San Francisco. They're playing at the Octopus Literary Salon tomorrow night. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Dark takes my mind.